From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly syndicated radio program produced in the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman, and today marks the ninth installment in our popular series, The Local Grain Revolution, a series that has become a pretty strong focus here on the show as an example of one of many projects underway throughout North America that is seeking to redefine how communities can access a safe, affordable, nutritious, and equitable supply of food. The Local Grain Revolution has focused on the Kootenai Grain CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture Project, that launched into its first year throughout the 2008 growing season, when three farmers in the Creston Valley of British Columbia planted 15 acres of grain for 180 members and one business. The Grain CSA is the first of its kind in Canada and one of only a handful in North America, and has helped inspire other similar and like-minded projects to sprout up as well, all of which have been helped along by Deconstructing Dinner's ongoing and in-depth coverage of the Grain CSA's evolution. And so on today's broadcast, we continue with our detailed coverage of the CSA's evolution and zero in once again on some of the meetings of the CSA's steering committee as they discuss year two of the project. These and past recordings of the meetings of the Grain CSA is a listening and learning opportunity not often found within media. And of the hours and hours of audio that we've recorded, this next hour will feature some of the more compelling discussions and debates that took place not long after the completion of the CSA's year one. These segments will introduce the CSA's decision to triple in size and incorporate more businesses into the project, and introduce yet another interesting model that has since been called RSA, or Retail Supported Agriculture. One announcement to share with you before we launch into part 9 of our Local Grain Revolution series is the return of Saskatchewan farmer Percy Schmeiser to BC, a familiar voice here on the show and certainly one of the most well-known farmers in the world. Percy will be returning to British Columbia in September and touring throughout the interior of the province, speaking once again to farmers and eaters on the dangers of genetically engineered food. Percy did visit BC last year in 2008 when he helped launch another project that we've also been following closely here on the show, GE Free Kootenays, a campaign currently underway in the Kootenai region of the province that is seeking to establish a region-wide zone that remains free of genetically engineered plants and trees. The campaign has successfully worked with three municipalities who have since declared themselves GE-free communities, and as part of Percy's return to the region, he'll be speaking in communities where farming is a significant part of the local economy, and in some cases are areas where genetically engineered crops are currently being cultivated. Percy's talk will therefore be acting as a great opportunity to engage in a dialogue with local farmers and explore what alternatives to growing genetically engineered crops might be available to them. Of course, the Kootenai Grain CSA that we'll be speaking of today is just one great example of one of those alternatives to growing genetically engineered crops. Grain CSA farmer Keith Huscroft will also be joining Percy as he launches his tour in Creston on September 15th. Percy will then travel to the city of Grand Forks, where he'll speak on September 16th, Salmon Arm September 18th, Vernon September 19th, and Kelowna September 20th. More information on the Percy Schmeiser tour is posted on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca, and we encourage you to pass along word to your friends or email lists about the tour. We've also included a Share This icon on that webpage, which can be used to share info about the tour through any social networking sites that you may use. Also to report is a recent article published on the U.S.-based website The Mother Nature Network. One of the network's writers compiled a list of the top 11 green food radio shows in the United States, and Deconstructing Dinner made it onto the list and is the only Canadian show among the 11. A link to that article is posted on the Deconstructing Dinner website. And also in the news, and a topic that will lead us into the focus of the show today, was a commentary that appeared in the August 19th edition of one of Canada's national newspapers, The National Post. Published in the paper's Financial Post section, the commentary was written by Manitoba farmer Rolf Penner, who is also the vice president of the Western Canadian Wheat Growers Association. Now, we mentioned this organization back in May, shortly after they and eight other organizations in Canada, the U.S., and Australia issued a statement calling for the development and commercialization of genetically engineered wheat. And sure enough, Rolf Penner's commentary in the National Post was again calling for this commercialization of GE wheat. Now, we did also mention on that broadcast that Penner's Western Canadian Wheat Growers Association had invited Dennis Avery of the U.S.-based Center for Global Food Issues to keynote their annual convention hosted back in January. Avery is known among a large subsection of the food and agricultural community as one of the most uninformed yet vocal figures on the subject of food and farming. And we suggested on that show how dangerous it might be for such a large group of Canadian farmers to be receiving information from someone who, as was demonstrated on our April 30th, 2009 episode, is as misinformed on food and farming as he is. Avery is also one of the more well-known climate change deniers. That is, he denies that mankind's actions are affecting the global climate. And sure enough, the danger of having invited Avery to speak at the Western Canadian Wheat Growers Annual Convention seems to have possibly manifested itself into Rolf Penner's August 19th commentary in the National Post. About halfway through his commentary, Penner writes this: "For those who, despite evidence to the contrary, are still convinced that mankind causes global warming, GM crops can play an important role in the reduction of CO2 dumping," end quote. So Rolf Penner does not believe in mankind's impact on the climate. Deconstructing Dinner will be keeping a close eye on how the prospect of genetically engineered wheat develops and perhaps further examine whether the Canadian government chooses to listen to a farmer organization that does not believe that mankind is having an impact on the Earth's climate. Now, moving on to a grain project that is responding to the known and harmful impacts our food system is having on the planet. In early June 2009, Deconstructing Dinner toured throughout Ontario, stopping in the cities of Kingston and Ottawa to deliver a local grain revolution presentation. With the project and its coverage on the show having already inspired so many individuals and groups to seek out locally grown grains, it was hoped that the presentation might inspire others to do the same. And sure enough, an enthusiastic group in Kingston was formed to explore the possibility of launching a grain CSA in the Kingston area, and the process that they will likely go through will probably be similar to some of the dialogue and debates that we're about to listen in on today. To help introduce that dialogue, it's fitting to launch today's show with an audio clip of James McKinnon and Elisa Smith, the authors of The 100 Mile Diet, or as the book is titled in the United States, Plenty. James and Elisa are, of course, responsible for introducing and successfully launching the 100-mile diet craze across Canada, and which has certainly spilled over into the United States, and so it was rewarding that the Kootenay Grain CSA was mentioned as part of a recent lecture that the two authors delivered. The lecture was broadcast on May 31st on TV Ontario's Big Ideas, a popular television show and podcast.
You're listening to Big Ideas, the only regularly scheduled television program in North America devoted to the art of the lecture and the importance of ideas in public life. It is broadcast on TVO every Saturday and Sunday at 4 p.m. For more information on our program, go to our website at tvo.org/bigideas.
People are having ideas that we hadn't even thought of when we started. We did a speaking tour last year in the Kootenay region of British Columbia, and that's in the southeastern corner in a very mountainous zone. And they actually have grain elevators 100 years old that are standing empty there right now that we saw as we did this tour. And, you know, we're just pointing at them going, look at that. That's really neat. But again, you can't find that locally grown wheat there. And we did a talk at a local community library. And everyone was saying, yeah, it's true. All those old grain elevators are standing empty and we don't have any wheat here anymore. We can't buy it. It's really sad. And then in the back, this farmer put up her hand and said, actually, I grew tons of wheat this summer. It's sitting in my barn. I don't have any way to clean it or anybody to sell it to. So instantly, everyone got really excited. They all stood up and took out their checkbooks, and they're like, we'll buy it. We'll buy you the machine so you can clean it. And in that moment of community with people just coming together, they realized that they could really make a change in their community. Since then, they've had even more interesting ideas. They started a grain sort of co-op, it's called a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, where people pay a subscription fee in advance so that the farmers can start up this crop. Particularly when you're starting a new crop for the first time, it's a bit of an economic commitment for a farmer that's hard to make. So they got 180 people together. They all paid $100. That's $18,000. And that's a good start. And the farmers who decided to participate in that, they started thinking more about the idea of food sustainability. And they thought, well, that's great that people in our local area are getting together to do this. Let's see how much fossil fuel we can take out of this equation here. They thought, well, let's put away our tractors. Let's farm by horse. And that's what they did. And then at the end of the season, there's a sailing association there. They have a very large lake, Kootenay Lake. And the sailors said, well, we've got these boats here. We just sort of sail around for fun. Why don't we sail the wheat to market from where it's grown? So that's what they did this October. It takes about a day. They shipped it from Creston, where it was grown, all on the lake, to Nelson, which is the largest town in the community. So almost no fossil fuels in that entire equation.
And that's why it would be good if we could start to look at where this is going, even today, and so that we can start to plan a few years down the road. I mean, last year we started with not knowing anything. Mm-hmm. This year, this has been a pilot, so we didn't know how it was going to work. It seems to have worked, so now we can say, how big do we want to let this get, and how many years ahead do we want to try to forecast, you know?
That's Brenda Bruns, one of the co-founders of the Kootenay Grain CSA, speaking at a meeting held in November 2008, not long after year one of the project wrapped up. Before that was a clip of Elisa Smith and James McKinnon, authors of The 100 Mile Diet, speaking on TV Ontario's Big Ideas. Following some of the grain being delivered to members via sailboat, the Kootenay Grain CSA had successfully grown, harvested, and delivered a little over 80 pounds of five varieties of grain to each of the CSA's 180 members and 1,600 pounds to one business. The November meeting of the CSA's steering committee that followed that first year was the first gathering held to discuss what worked and what didn't work throughout that first year. Here's CSA co-founder Matt Lowe, who chaired that meeting.
I talked to Brendan, and we thought a good way to start this meeting would be to talk about what did and didn't work for each and everybody here. Say what they need to say, not hold back, and that's how we can move forward for next year.
I really liked the farm tours that we did. I think that really mm-hmm. helped to make us feel like we were part of the process. Mm-hmm. I think at the end, when we got our grain, it would have been good if we could have given people, now perhaps you gave this out and I missed it, but information on how to prepare whole grains. I think most people don't really have a clue.
I've had so many people coming into the bookstore looking for how do I bake bread, you know, what do I do with whole grains, and this is good. Like, this is, mm-hmm. you know, and I've had even men saying, my mother knew this or my father knew this, mm-hmm. and why didn't I pay attention? Because now I don't know what to do with my whole grain. And the men are interested as well in how to cook with it. So,
I mean, I've thoroughly enjoyed this whole thing. It's been just such a rewarding experience. Time-wise, it's been a lot of time, so I'm keen about exploring that idea of getting someone to actually take this on in a paid capacity. If we're going to get bigger, I don't know if I want to increase my amount of volunteer hours. I think it's been a wonderful success. Mm-hmm. It's certainly inspired a lot of people. I've really enjoyed working with all of you. I mean, this project wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for just the really special people that I think have come together. And now we've created a model in this 1 year, which is a model that I think so many other parts of the world are really wanting. I think we could improve our list, and that's what I see a coordinator could do. And certainly if we're going to expand, we can improve our contact list and so on. You know, contacting people hasn't been the easiest at times. Some people haven't provided email addresses. Some people don't have emails, of course. Some people have unlisted numbers now. So it would be great to have someone that can keep up with this stuff. And I think as a really integral part of a CSA is a newsletter, and that's something we talked about, but we didn't have time to do. We really do need to educate people. I mean, we were just talking about some of the issues, but in order to maintain, I think, a solid market for the farmers, we need to keep educating, and we need to keep the buyers involved. So certainly that's the type of stuff that a coordinator does, and I think as a project like this grows, I think it really does beg a coordinator. And then a bunch of committed volunteers still, because there's lots of work.
Now, some of these topics of educating members and hiring a coordinator will be examined in greater detail later on the show and also as part of next week's broadcast. But that round of feedback also heard from the three farmers. Drew Gilius, for one, was very happy with the outcomes of year one, but he did raise a notable challenge that the farmers and CSA encountered, a challenge that certainly any other community wishing to launch a similar project should be well aware of.
It is I think it's a very good thing for farmers. I really do. I believe this is a very good thing because that is very true. Just like Wayne said, for us to be able to grow something, know we've sold it, is a big thing.
At a reasonable price,
it's great. Mm-hmm. So that part of it, I think, is fantastic for farmers. Mm-hmm. But the problem I can see is when we try to pool all of our farms into one, it gets logistically a problem. Mm-hmm.
I understand that.
You know, and that is something which I don't know quite how to get around. If that's, you know, a true CSA, I guess if we ran our own CSA, we'd grow 1 acre. And if that 1 acre got wiped out, our shareholders would say, well, sorry, you know, your acre, but we knew that at the head of time, you know. Mm-hmm. But when we pool, it sounds nice to pool everything, and that's a nice thing. Mm-hmm. But how then do we make it work smoothly?
This is Deconstructing Dinner. Now, beyond the challenges of pooling the product of the three farms together as part of this community-supported agriculture project, were the challenges faced by members and just how they might use the 80 pounds of whole grains at home. While the November 2008 meeting was one to gauge whether the project should expand into year two, steering committee member Abra Brin cautioned the group of this challenge.
I'm kind of feeling the need to be a little bit of a devil's advocate simply because I've been trying to increase local production and consumption for almost 20 years in this region, and it's certainly a very different time right now with peak oil and climate change and the 100-mile diet, but we know that there's a huge demand in the idea of the grains. But we haven't yet seen how the consumers are going to handle these grains. And we've already had people indicate that people don't really know what to do with the whole grain. Mm-hmm. Few people have the ability to crack their own limits for themselves. So, like, there's no guarantee that the people that got 100 pounds of grain this fall are going to not be there next spring kind of going, what am I supposed to do with this yet?
Yeah.
So I think we need to wait and see a little bit before, and I mean, obviously we've got time before you're planting anything again, but consumers are pretty fickle because we're really, really used to ease to convenience.
So maybe in a couple of months we could pull email or call the people.
I think it's essential that we go back to the shareholders and find out how it's really working out for
them. And in the meantime, perhaps feed them as much information as we can about what to do.
This challenge of educating CSA members on how to use the grains in the kitchen was responded to by farmer Joanne Galeas, who offered classes in Creston on how to use the grains at home, while Lorraine Carlstrom of Nelson offered classes to members there. And you might recall our last installment of this Local Grain Revolution series when we listened in on one of Lorraine's workshops. And so fast forwarding to January 2009, when the CSA Steering Committee met yet again, Joanne did share some of the feedback that she received from members at her January class offered in Creston.
When I taught the course at the library, there was it 22 people there? Most of them hadn't opened a bag yet. That was about a month after it had been delivered. They were excited, but almost no one had knowledge of using them before. And so over the last 2 weeks, in anticipation of this meeting, I've been asking everyone who comes into my clinic or I just run into in town, and none have any expectation they will use all of what they've received this year within the year. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. And even two that I know very well, and one is a really heavy baker. She does a lot of baking, won't use her, and she has two children and a
She doesn't have a grinder?
No, she has a grinder. She uses it, but she uses white flour still in a lot of the things she does, and she won't use it. So it was actually a bit of a surprise. Mm-hmm. But what people are very happy with what they have. Mm-hmm. But going through the 81 or 83 pounds, whatever we ended up with, is not happening in most places.
Now, when these challenges were brought to the table at the CSA's January meeting, an in-depth discussion ensued that followed up on the suggestion to survey the membership and determine how they had fared thus far with their grains. A survey would also help the CSA better plan what to grow as part of the CSA's year two. Weighing in on the discussion were CSA farmers Drew Gillius and Keith Huscroft, and CSA committee members Abra Brin, Jeremy Lack, Wayne Harris, Brenda Bruns, and Matt Lowe. The discussion evolved in a rather interesting way as it was learned that what CSA members want needs to also be in line with a long-term plan of what crops work best on the three farms and what works as part of a healthy crop rotation that ideally would take place over a 7-year period. Organic grain farming, after all, needs to more specifically take into consideration how the crops build soil fertility over time.
This sort of information is important, but also it's kind of like it can potentially be opening a can of worms if we start to cater too much to everybody's individual preferences. Then we might as well be a commercial store. Yeah, I think it's important to know how it's working for people, but at the same time, the simplicity of a CSA model, I think, is really important. Just like a vegetable CSA, I mean, you get whatever.
You get kale for 3 months.
Yeah, or you get 20 pounds of potatoes and a pound of carrots, because that's what's...
I think some of I agree with you, Matt. Yeah. I think also, though, that if we want to sell shares, we have to cater to what people want as well.
Yeah.
So there's we walk a bit of a fine line there as to figuring out. And because we can change the varieties we grow, that's something that's quite easy to do. I think when we take a survey, it just gives us a bit of an idea where maybe to head.
Yeah.
What about even asking, like, what are your top three grains that you've used?
That's important.
Very much. Because, you know, I was thinking, just projecting down the road, if we're getting a larger variety of grains grown, that a share wouldn't necessarily include that full range, but there could be like the core group. Like, I know I go through way more hard wheat than I go through soft wheat. So I could get a core selection of so many pounds of each, and then I'd have an option to choose two more from four options or five options or something. Yeah.
And as long as people selected far enough ahead of the growing season that the farmers could then adapt to grow enough of whatever is selected.
Yeah. It's the only way to keep it simple with the variety we already have.
Yeah.
I think one more thing to keep in mind is crop diversity, right? And I know you guys have talked about that, like the importance of not narrowing it too much so that we have that diversity that encourages resilience. And
maybe some of that, not to open another can of worms, but maybe some of that means that because we're small, we wouldn't want to grow 7 different varieties. We might choose and grow 4 different varieties. Another farmer would choose some others, but to keep the different varieties going.
I think it's partly changing the thinking around how we acquire our food, to deciding ahead of time what we're going to use or need and learning that. I don't think many people really think about how much of different things they use in the course of a year. And so we're learning to pre-think that, pre-order and take responsibility for our food at the front of the season rather than going to the store and expecting there to be a surplus there for us to select from.
But the issue is, of course, the end user has to use the product. And so, like for me, I'm one of those convenience people, so I just gave grain away to everybody in my circle and said, would you use this? And if you would, how would you use it? And if you like it, are you going to buy a share next year? And what happened was some people started using it and really loved it and said, yes, I'm going to get a share next year. Other people said, I don't know how to grind. Or now they're online looking at, should I buy a Vitamix? Or should I buy a... And they're assessing grinders. And then, what sort of convenience is this? And so, I mean, if we want people to change their lifestyle, it's not an easy process. It hasn't been that easy for me. So we need to get, for example, if we are recommending that people buy a particular product, we need to get that company online and get them pushing natural grains for us. We need to get them involved in what we're doing. I don't know how else people are going to learn to change. I don't know how we do that.
I think the focus seems a bit strange. The CSA exists to make the farmers have a living, not whether the consumer gets exactly what they want. There's a sort of slightly wrong emphasis there.
Absolutely.
Because the CSA is not going to exist without these guys, right? And if they're not happy with what they're doing, what they can make out of it, then it's finished.
Yeah, but I mean, as long as we're going to be happy growing and getting paid adequately for what we grow, So if we, as long as we know that what we're growing is appreciated or going to be used, because if it isn't, we'll grow something else. I mean, we're not really growing a lot of varieties, or, you know, what are we up to, a half a dozen or something. So if we had to, if we switch three out and switch three different ones in, and I think we should be doing that, or at least trying something new every year, even if we never use it again, or it just stocks, everybody stocks up on it. Like, there's a lot of things we could probably grow, you know, an acre of that might be available for shareholders for 2 or 3 or 4 years to store. You know, I think we really have to keep it exciting and keep people interested. I think we have to, keep trying different stuff. Huh? Yeah. We have to what?
You have to make money.
Well, yeah. Well, no, that's part of it. But I mean, we're not saying devote huge acreages. But I mean, if it's a half an acre, an acre, I mean, it's still something that's cast us that we can see selling. But it doesn't have to go every year.
One of the main thrusts is to be organic and sustainable. And in order for that to happen, you really have to look pretty seriously at your rotation. Like, I think in many cases you'll be looking at either a 5 or 7 year rotation to do it properly. And you'll probably need to incorporate some legumes in there, whether you harvest them or whether you plow them down. So that rotation is going to have to play into it as time goes on too. Or there's going to be issues with the sustainability of it right there.
Do you know, I used Roy's lentils. Seriously, it took me a while to pick through all the little things, so I'm glad we're getting a gravity table this year. But I think that for a lot of people who may not know how to use a whole grain of camu, lentils aren't quite so foreign. So I think actually including legumes in as a share option would be a really good idea, and it would help with that rotation.
Well, it's good for both parties, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See, one of the things I think about those, because the reason why I think we need some feedback is partly because this grain CSA isn't something's been done. We don't have a model really to follow, and so to know what we should be growing as far as grains, because it's a totally different thing. Mm-hmm. Vegetables are one thing, but grains, if people want, we really have to grow what they're going to really use. So that's why I think, and even though I agree that you know, we don't want to get too, you know, thinking everybody to think that they're going to put in their order sort of idea, mm-hmm. I still think it helps us to lean in the direction mm-hmm. that is going to make it work in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Farmer Drew Gillius. On this part 9 of the Local Grain Revolution series here on Deconstructing Dinner, we are listening in on recordings from the discussions and debates that are helping move this innovative local grain project into what is now nearing the end of its second year in operation. Today's episode is archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the August 20th, 2009 episode. Past episodes of the series are also archived there. Now, as became clear among the discussions we listened in on in those previous segments, a survey of the CSA's members was recognized as a critical piece in helping determine how the project should evolve into its second year. Not long after the January 2009 meeting of the CSA Steering Committee, an online survey was sent out to the membership, and a surprising 118 members responded to the survey, certainly a sign of an eager and supportive membership. And the results were quite interesting. Of the 118 members who responded to whether or not they were satisfied with the quality of the grain, 70% said they were completely satisfied, 24% mostly satisfied, 6% were undecided. Some of the comments that accompanied those responses were members finding too many hulls in the oats, some found it difficult accessing a mill to grind the grains into flour, some members who tried sprouting the oats were unable to sprout them, and some members hadn't even yet tried the grains. There were, of course, many members who indicated that the flavor of the grains was exceptional. Another question posed to members was on the preferred size of the share. While members expected to receive 100 pounds of grains, they received a little over 80 pounds come harvest. 35% of respondents were happy with the 80 pounds, 40% would prefer 100 pounds, and 25% would prefer 160 pounds. As a member myself, I ran out of all of my grains, other than my oats, about a month ago, and I would lean more towards the 160 pounds for the coming year, as it did require some getting used to having all of this grain in the house. Baking bread, pastries, rolling oats, and making pasta is quite the lifestyle shift that I, and I know many other members, are still adjusting to. Also questioned in the survey was the price per share. Were members satisfied with the $100 share price in the first year? 89% said it was appropriate, 9% thought it was too cheap, and 2% too expensive. As for the grains the members used the most at the time of the survey, the Hartspring wheat topped out the list, followed by oats, spelt, red fife wheat, and at the end of the list, Khorasan wheat. And perhaps the most important survey question of all was, would you join next year? And of the 118 respondents, 115 said yes.
Well, music, well, it's farming. Be careful what you're planting. I miss and make sure we plant soul food, or else your soul's gonna be starving. And music, well, it's farming. Higher meditation. I know that music feed your structure. I'm telling you, farming feed the nation, you know. Well, instead of cash crops, we need someone jobs. And instead of mansions, we need more farm plots. We no want no blood money in a no dead chops, dead chops. In them roadblock, it's your roots, rock and reggae rhythm, revolution.
I'm not a man who afraid to get my hands dirty. Deep in the soil, Rasta man is so earthly. Plant more seeds are just trees of beauty. Don't push no war, just love are with duty, yo. World leaders, what are your priorities? So many wars, but none on world poverty. So many hungry, so many unhealthy. Locked in this jungle, concrete monstrosity.
Well, music, well, it's farming. We plant and watch it grow, eh? I mean, no, sir, if we plant in love, then we are gonna never reap in sorrow no more. Well, the music, well, is farming. Sometimes my mud up in a studio. Sometimes my mud up on a stage show. Until me rust up on a stage, so you know. Well, instead of cash pots, we need more one jobs. We need some farm plots. We no want no blood money in a no dead chops, dead chops. Bobbing on roadblock, this your roots, rock and reggae rhythm. Revolution won't stop, come again.
Instead of cash crops, we need more white drops.
We'll be working on your cultivation.
Well, there's two things. I mean, I think just quickly we should talk about the possibility of this increasing threefold. So to 600, that would be probably a combination of individual shareholders and business shareholders like those Soleil Levant.
The Roots Underground, followed by the Kootenai Grain CSA's co-founder Matt Lowe, who was recorded proposing at the November 2008 meeting of the CSA Steering Committee that the project triple in size from 200 shares to 600 shares. On today's episode of Deconstructing Dinner, we're listening to recordings from the meetings that followed the successful first year of what was and is Canada's first community-supported agriculture, or CSA, project for grain. Having delivered close to 20,000 pounds of locally and organically grown grains to 180 families and one business in the Kootenai region of British Columbia, CSA steering committee members appeared eager to see the project triple in size as it continued into its second year of operation, that's this year. The discussion that ensued following Matt's proposal was quite exciting as the steering committee began speaking of the many options available as to what other crops might be grown as part of the project. As an example of the possibilities, farmer Roy Lawrence, as we heard earlier, had already grown a test plot of lentils in year one that grew really well, and I can testify personally, also tasted great. CSA members received a small bag of the lentils along with their other grains. And the discussion of what to grow in year two even included a brief exchange on the prospect of cultivating hemp, which in a province known for its outdoor cultivation of cannabis and the inherent risks of cross-pollination between the smokable forms and the edible and wearable forms, it was quickly decided among the group that it might be better to pursue other crops instead.
Are you guys keen to see that happen? Or because I really think it's possible for... So it would be to go to 600 shares next year.
Yeah, I kind of would like to go to get my share up to around 20 acres. And what would that be? Probably 15 or 16 acres maybe in the CSA with a few, or maybe a little over 20 acres if we tried something else. But I want to, you know...
Yeah, I'm just thinking next year.
I'm going to put in... I got this one ton of this organic red, or I grew it. It was an organic seed.
Yeah.
And I got a ton off it. And I'm going to plant all of that. So I'm going to have 20 acres of hard red spring wheat.
Yeah.
Okay? I don't care if only 2 or 3 acres gets taken. It's just the fact that I got it. I want to plant it.
Okay.
And it does, and some of it's going to be new ground, and I don't know how it's going to be. So I'm going to do that. But on top of that, whatever you want to come up with.
Yeah, there, folks, what do you...
I think we're willing to increase. It would be nice, though, to be able to go away and think about it.
Definitely. Oh, yeah, it's not today. We don't need to know today, but just to throw it out there, that if it seems like a possibility.
And that's the through and Joanne, you can't, by scale, expand much as far as how much you grow, but your involvement may grow if you're doing more of the cleaning.
Yeah.
And looking at some of the legumes and, you know, different...
Yeah, that sounds good with us.
So that does become the next question. When we started to ask people what they'd like as part of their share, a number of people said oil crops. So, you know, flax is an option, or I guess hemp. I don't know what the implications are of growing a hemp crop here.
That's supply management still, isn't it? Hemp or a license, or what is it?
I think you have to be licensed. Yeah. I think there may be issues with some of the other hemp growers.
Oh, right. Yeah. Kenny ran into that, didn't
And I don't... How do you address that? I don't... That's my question.
I think the issue was that they were concerned about cross-pollinating.
And did they... You know, my question is, did it? Did it cross-pollinate and cause
the problem?
Okay, all right.
So we might be looking at flax.
Okay.
Yeah, so it wasn't a problem for Cam and Kenny, it was a problem for
the plot.
And then they weren't happy.
What can they say?
Well, actually, it's a larger money industry.
What is it? Bigger than
pay us not to grow it.
And forestry altogether.
Yeah, I think we should just forget about that.
Okay, so we'd be looking at flax as a possibility. And legumes, I had a lot of people saying.
Yeah,
you know,
they're awesome.
I've got my 15 kinds of beans saved, and we're planting half an acre.
Wow.
So how do sunflower seeds do in this valley?
That's another one that people have been asking about.
How do you...
The coldest crop in the world to... I grew sunflowers one year, and I think we combined them on about November 20th. And I had a combine without a cab, and I had been so cold in all my life. But it was cold, really cold.
So it's a very long season crop.
Yeah, and we had a lot of problems with birds that year. The birds probably took half the crop.
Oh, no doubt.
And how do you harvest it? How do you get them?
They're actually very easy to combine.
Oh, good.
You do need to modify the reel a bit, because the way the flowers hook over, they would hook on the back, and that's the other thing with an open combine. And the thing would run around until it flew up and hit the car. So it had its challenge. It was a very pretty crop to grow.
Yeah.
But if we're going to be at all serious about oilseed, that's even more challenging than grains in terms of making it edible for people.
Yeah. We bought flax oil from a guy, organic flax oil he's near Highwood. Yeah, and his press is not very big. It's amazingly small.
Seems like what needs to happen if someone has the time, certainly we can put it out there, someone to do the research on the possibility of oils and small presses and so on. And I really like what Roy did this year in growing the 1 acre of lentils, and there are a few other crops that I have in mind too, and I think it's a really nice way to experiment and introduce a crop into the CSA is by going small scale, you know, sample packs almost.
But we want to make sure that Roy gets compensated for that, because far he has given.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's just paid for his own seed. He did all that work. He's given seed to all the shareholders. Yeah. So now I think the CSA maybe can take the role
of marketing for Roy the fact that he has this available. Please save me 10 pounds.
Well, I would like to, like, I'd like to suggest that we put the lentils, add the lentils on, or, and this is another thought I had was we could have two different chairs. We could have a grain chair or a more like a wheat slash oat chair, you know, along the lines of what we went with this year. And then there's a few other crops that I'm curious about, and the lentils, I would like to see that be part of the CSA next year. Mm-hmm. Quinoa is another one. Quinoa is, you get top dollar for that grain, and it's really popular. It's one of the most complete foods from what I understand. It's a very nutritious food. And one idea that that I started mulling around just yesterday, actually, because I had we've got a young woman in our eco-society office who did some research. She researched if there are any machines that are being used to do quinoa, to harvest quinoa, and she wasn't able to find any information on that. What she found was in where a lot of the quinoa is grown in South America, they actually do it by hand, and it's quite easy to harvest by hand and to process the there's a little cover that comes off very easily. And so one idea I wondered about next year was to grow small scale, and whoever wanted a share of quinoa, they could come and actually do the harvesting and do their own processing, because it would be hand, and it would be a great way for people, for shareholders, to get involved. And it seems like quinoa really lends itself to that. It's actually being grown in Canada, and lots of backyard growing. It grows well here. She also did some research on rice. It seems to be too long a growing crop, although wild rice is certainly something I wanted to talk about today, because it seems like there's it's being grown in Saskatchewan commercially, wild rice.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. Following that discussion, a one-acre test plot of quinoa was sourced from farmers in Peru and was then planted at Drew and Joanne Galeas' farm. Unfortunately, a lot of the quinoa did not germinate, but to help support what did grow, in the early part of the summer, I joined Matt Lowe and another CSA member on a day trip to Creston to help weed the 1 acre of quinoa. Because of the low germination rate, the quinoa will likely only be used as seed for next year. Now, with this plan to expand the grain CSA threefold, some important issues were needing to be discussed, among them the need to build more processing capacity to handle all of this grain. As CSA farmers and steering committee members discussed the need for processing capacity at that November 2008 meeting, farmer Drew Galeas expressed his interest to take on the task of processing the CSA's grains. After all, his farm is the smallest of the three, and he has more time available to take on that processing role. The discussion also led into the future need to seek out or develop storage capacity as well. Here's farmer Drew Galeas.
We also should have another, you know, machine. The fanning mill works great, but the fanning mill doesn't do everything. So we need more complex machines.
Well, they have these portable things that they haul around in trailers that are supposed to
there's be all kinds of stuff out there.
You know, I was just talking to somebody, said, yeah, you can get a 40-foot trailer where the grain comes in out one end and the sack flies out the other. So,
cool.
Perfect.
That
cost. You got plug it into the wall?
Yeah, they're
but I mean, you know, but it caught their, you know, they're $40,000 or $50,000 for a complete unit.
At least. Yeah. I just saw a couple on the internet for $90,000.
Okay, well, there you go.
I do think the time is right for being able to get some serious grants, though. Like, everybody's got environmental grants these days. Van City would probably be worthwhile approaching, and there's been lots of buzz about this. So I think if we could frame grant proposals as consolidating this initiative so that it's long-term sustainable, and we can clearly develop it as a working model that can be replicated elsewhere, there's a lot of agencies would be interested in something like that.
I don't know, what is everybody's thoughts on what do they think? We were willing to, we talked about it, said, well, you know, we should put in a proper cleaning spot. So we've talked about it and sort of have made steps towards doing that. And I thought, well, maybe there's funds you can access or something, maybe the government can help, or, you know, I don't know how that works, but anyway. But we had talked, but I thought, well, that's really up to everybody to decide if they would want to use that, or if it's better. The whole CSA wanted to set up their own system, or any one of the farmers wanted to set up the system, you know, before we went ahead and said anything. That's where we're coming from, I think.
Has it been too long since there was much grain production in the Creston Valley that there's, like, are there still people around from the last time there was grain growing who would have the skills to, like, take over cleaning?
Yeah, well, you wouldn't take over.
Dad doesn't have equipment, but he has the knowledge, but
But actually,
what's his name's? Never.
But far as the cleaning goes, though, there used to be pipers that did it.
Yes.
Christensen's.
Eastman's.
Eastman still do.
Mr. Mulligan had a cleaner.
He's still got one, yeah. Or whoever has that place.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be that it's cooperatively shared. We're talking community where we have a whole bunch of little businesses and we support each other's business, yeah. And you've got economic strength for the valley. So mm-hmm. I like that model where we have little businesses springing up to meet the needs locally as we build a demand. So
is the distance good. Prohibitive for you guys?
Pardon me?
Is the distance too far for you guys?
Well, it would be totally different if I just brought my grain and dropped it off. Mm-hmm.
That's a big smile.
Thinking is, you grow the grain, you drop it off, then we clean it, and we get a certain so much for cleaning it. You know, and that is, and I'm like I say, we're not in this, my gosh, to make money, but
oh, that'd be a nice idea.
But we've sort of been farming long enough to understand what it's like.
Yeah, I understand that we knew it.
No, but that's what this is supposed to address. You guys are supposed to make some money.
Well, whatever we can do, but that's the idea, would be to just drop off the grain. And, you know, you guys wouldn't have to stay here and clean it.
But and what Brenda's right is that what you're really trying to build here is local capacity.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and local, in this case, local processing capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And if one of the farmers is involved with that, it's that much better because, it just is that much better in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're...
I agree.
Definitely work well.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, I heard that there was a fair bit of work for you involved in the cleaning. It could be just working out the kinks and the whole how do you manage what. But integrating into your own farm activities, if you are the one running it, and providing that service for everybody, and I'd like people to think about whether the payment would be in monetary exchange or grain exchange. So upping your grain quota on the farm, so to speak. But I think it seems that you're really busy, so I'm assuming there'd only be so much cleaning you could undertake in any one growing season.
Actually, CR, really, we actually found we had, because we don't grow the number of acres, we had time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Roy is very busy, but we're sort of slacked off because our farm is only 40 acres. So at that time, we have...
Well, you know, it was set up, you know, like this year was making a
year there.
If you
had
it set up properly, it would be like a 10-4.
See, our system we had set up this year, you know, just because it was just trying to get it all going, it really was awkward. But to have a system set up where it's basically turn it on and go, I think, because a grain cleaner will work on, you know, you don't need to be there all the time. You can turn them on, and I could go do other things, and it could run. And
okay.
You know,
the other thing is if you the local market continues to grow, you necessarily wouldn't deliver all the grain at the same time in the fall. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, you might be cleaning grain all winter long, or your cleaning season might just keep getting stretched further and further.
It will be dairy farming before you know
yeah,
it.
There you go.
The bigger bakeries or something, they don't have to take their ton or whatever all at once.
Oh, no,
the
storage, they don't want to.
Well, and actually, Drew and I talked about that storage becomes an issue. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, halfway around our walk this morning.
So I wonder if you need to find a place locally that the grain could be stored and distributed from that might not be on site, you know, on your 40 acres. Maybe
there's it really has to be mouse-proof and dry.
Yeah,
all the grain.
But I'm sure that such places do exist in the valley.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. You're listening to recordings from meetings among the farmers and steering committee members of the Kootenai Grain CSA, Canada's first community-supported agriculture project for grain, now into its second year in the Creston Valley of British Columbia. These segments were recorded in November 2008 and January 2009, not long after year one of the project wrapped up and year two entered into its planning stages. Similar to that last discussion on building the processing and storage capacity in the valley to accommodate any future growth of the CSA was a discussion on seed saving and farming practices. While not certified organic, the CSA has committed to cultivating grains using organic principles, and with organic grain growing being new to at least one of the three farmers, CSA co-founder Matt Lowe suggested to the group that the CSA invite experts from outside of the region to share their knowledge on organic grain growing with farmers in the region. Here's a segment from that discussion.
Well, so eventually you might want to try to get to the point where you've got more than 1 year's seed, too.
Oh, that's a neat idea.
In case you do have a crop failure. Oh, you don't want to take it and put it in a vault in Norway, but you want to keep growing it out. Yep. But to hold, have more than 1 year would be fairly
wise.
Be a good idea.
Yeah.
You guys have all said that you would really like some organic farm knowledge to come into the community in terms of speakers to help increase your knowledge. And so we've talked about February, this trying to make this happen in February. We'd have to raise some money to do that, and that's in this proposal. I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts on what you envision this being.
Steve Snyder too, this guy.
I was sitting here thinking about him.
Yeah.
He has a lot of cleaning and milling experience.
And
too.
And his dad seems to be pretty involved too. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they give us, you know, I'm kind of looking at the magazines or whatever that I get, you know, the farm periodicals are more into this biodynamic farming where, you know, it's more, you know, soil preparations that you put on and rock powders and, you know, composting and stuff like that. So it'd be nice if you had someone in that, or even if it's a farmer who's doing that, who's working more, you know, if you had a good biodynamic farmer who was, you know, that was working that way, that's something that I'd be
The idea, Matt, is that you're going to open this to other interested parties.
For sure. That's going to be advertised throughout the Columbia Basin, if that's mm-hmm. who we get as one of our funders. And for especially for anybody, but I think especially directed towards farmers, any farmer.
Well, I think for me personally, or for us, we, you know, anything learning about crop rotations and you know, green manures and cover crops and all those, that's really valuable. Weed control, you know, because there's a lot of information on.
Yeah.
And talking to somebody that's used that and that's done it would sure be valuable.
Mm-hmm. It's very important too that the farmers that are involved with the CSA mm-hmm. now are able to grow to where they want to be and be successful at it, because that'll encourage other farmers to say, well, maybe I can grow without herbicide and make a living, which, you know, there's still an awful lot of skepticism about growing organically.
That discussion, which was recorded in November 2008, is what later led to a February 2009 visit by experienced organic grain farmer Stephen Snyder of Little Red Hen Mills, a 2,080-acre certified organic farm near Camrose, Alberta. Stephen has been farming organically since 1986 and cultivates 1,600 acres of crops, green manures, and hay. His visit to help educate the CSA and other area farmers provides yet another example of the importance of launching local food projects as a way to enhance the capacity of a region to grow food using more sustainable farming methods. These fascinating discussions that we've been listening to have taken place as part of the evolution of the Kootenai Grain CSA and will continue into next week's episode, when we'll also listen in on another grain workshop hosted by CSA member Lorraine Carlstrom, and that one on the ins and outs of sprouting grain, yet another interesting way to make whole grains more digestible and to allow our bodies to better access the nutrients found within whole grains. If you missed Lorraine's workshop on sourdough, that show has been archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under our Local Grain Revolution page. And so as we near the end of today's broadcast, we'll leave you with another segment of recordings from the November 2008 and January 2009 meetings of the Grain CSA, when the group discussed the opportunity to invite more businesses to become members. This topic will be discussed in greater detail on next week's episode and will certainly be one to explore further as this series progresses, because the interest to invite more businesses to become members of this CSA model really does introduce a similar yet new model, Retail Supported Agriculture, or RSA. Here's Grain CSA co-founder Brenda Bruns.
One thing that I would like to be able to do with some of that surplus, I kept wishing we had a little bit of surplus, is to distribute small amounts to the bakeries and co-ops in the area.
Promotion's a good idea.
And see if they would like to test it out. I know Yuri wanted to test out here and wanted to have a line of locally
local ingredient breads. Mm-hmm. I know the bakery up the lake wanted some, and there's a bakery in Invermere that wants some, and there's a Caslow group, a co-op, that wanted to be able to sell it. So maybe if we're looking toward supplying larger shares, which is more convenient for you guys anyway than a whole bunch of individual shares, that's the other piece about local eating, that, you know, if we can also supply retailers so that people can go out and purchase their grain that's locally grown.
Okay, and so then the other thing, is it okay if we bring a couple more businesses on board and then do a combination of individual and business shares in those 600? I think it's with a 75% model, so we were doing 75 cents a share to businesses.
Right.
But I would propose that we do the bulk of the shares to individuals, and I don't think we'll have any problem selling like 450 shares individuals and then the rest to businesses. Is that...
What was the price to the individual?
It was $1 a pound, and then for the businesses it was 75 cents a pound.
And this year it's going to be, do we know that yet?
We had said 125.
Yeah. So the business will go up to...
If I could make a suggestion, I know Matt knows this, I'm a big supporter of the idea of bringing businesses on board with this, mostly in part because I think, and we've been talking about this already, that from a lifestyle perspective, I don't think people are quite ready yet to have mm-hmm. so much grain. Mm-hmm. I know for me, mm-hmm. trying to change my lifestyle has been tough. But so I do support that, and I think it would be good to try to limit how many shares go out to businesses and at the same time try to expand how many businesses can be brought on board so that every business can somehow maybe incorporate it into their marketing. So a small bakery, for example, in Balfour, or a small bakery in Nelson, mm-hmm. can market how they're now part of the CSA. So that only helps spread the message of the CSA, but it gives their customers a taste of, you know, mm-hmm. local grain mm-hmm. instead of, say, just picking the co-op or just picking, mm-hmm. you know, Ossoli-Levant or the Kootenay Baker. Really just sort of spread it around and set it up so that if this CSA decided to continue really focusing on businesses, that there'd be a lot more avenues opened up mm-hmm. for that.
Okay, one thing issue to bring up on that, I think, is storage. Because we don't have any storage for this grain. Uh-huh. Once this grain's sold, basically, I think as a farmer, I want to get rid of it.
I think if we sell them, we got to say you have to take it.
That has
you
to be. Have yeah. to, okay.
And I think, too, by bringing many more businesses on board, you start to get them experiencing what it's like and what they would want in the future. So, you know, crop planning what crops should be grown and could be grown becomes a little more easy. And, yeah.
And the beauty of grain, it doesn't go bad. Because I remember I bought 800 pounds of garlic, and by Christmas it had all frozen. Mm-hmm. So the guy had, well, lucky for me, he gave me my money back. But I could have been stuck. Mm-hmm. Where with grain, it's not going to
stop. And I'm
going to
build some silos, so if I had to keep or take or hold some back, it wouldn't be a problem.
Okay.
And that wraps up today's episode of Deconstructing Dinner in part 9 of our Local Grain Revolution series. With the project having inspired others to embark on similar initiatives, you can expect to learn more about these and other projects on future episodes of the series as well. Here's one last clip of farmer Keith Huscroft, who farms using horses. He shares a rather funny exchange that he had with a neighbor that accurately captures the struggles that so many farmers, big or small, continue to have in trying to make a living growing food.
I told you about that one time that I was out there playing with my horses, and I had the mower hooked to my horses, and they were a little agitated, and I had them right beside the highway. My two horses hooked to the little horse.
The highway is Canyon Lister Road.
Yeah, Canyon Lister Road, right on the corner. And this big black, this huge tractor with 4 or 8 tires and this great big baler, like a big square baler on the back, these 4x1-ton bales, come up, and here I am. I was down here, and that kid's up there, and he stopped, and I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and I know we're both thinking the same thing. You can't make a living farming with that.
That was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenay Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. Deconstructing Dinner is distributed free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.